time has a way of erasing what has come before. Many of the answers to questions about those who preceded us lie beneath the ground, buried by time. The secrets of Gaelic Ireland's medieval past are being slowly uncovered by an archaeological team led by Thomas Finan, professor of history and director of the Center for Digital Humanities at St. Louis University. He's been digging in Ireland for a while now, about 5 years, but he's not been alone. This time he brought a film producer, writer, to document the work. That's Kathy Bratkowski, whose film True Gaelic, Unearthing Medieval Ireland is about to premiere in St. Louis. She and Tom Finan are with me in studio. I can understand why a Finan would want to go to Ireland and would be interested. A Bratkowski, not so much. Nonetheless, you both have been there and have their reasoning. Tom, what has inspired your interest in this part of the world and the archaeology?
Well, I think in one sense I'd have to be honest and say that, you know, the family background is at least a certain element. The name Finan does come from that neck of the woods. But, you know, really when you get down to it, it's because I like history and archaeology. And all through my education, being inspired by history and archaeology, and then progressively when I decided to make it a career, I focused on trying to find areas and places and events that were not very well studied. And somehow I ended up where I ended up at Loch Key.
I'll ask you more specifically about that in a moment, but ask Kathy, what about your own interest? I mean, what drew you into this project?
Well, actually, it was pretty much the brainchild of our president, Dennis Riggs, who learned about Tom's project through
HEC's
president, Dennis Riggs, who learned about Tom's project through the former U.S. Irish ambassador, Kevin O'Malley, who's actually a St. Louis University alum.
Yeah, he's been here.
And then, you know, met Tom. And I volunteered as well as four other people. So five of us were over there for a month last summer.
We'll have information on an airing this week of the film. But has HEC set a date for that yet? For your airing?
Or for our airing. It'll be within a couple of weeks on HEC TV. And
We'll keep folks posted on that. Okay, back to Tom now with regard to the site that you selected. I've seen the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so fascinating. I mean, to think that you're uncovering things like sewing needles that are hundreds and hundreds of years old is mind-boggling.
It is. It is. Yeah. And it's, I mean, in one sense, it's very typical for what you would find on archaeological sites. But I think what's atypical is that it's at a place that is really untouched in a lot of respects. So folks in the business, in archaeology and history in Ireland, have kind of known it's there but not known it's there. And it was just waiting for someone to actually stick a spade in the ground.
I guess knowing it's there is a result of just the location, the fact that there is water, people moved around by boat, so there probably had to be something at a location like that.
Right, and there are extant remains of other nearby sites.
Yeah.
So there's a castle on an island just off the coast. There's a very couple
impressive
monasteries. It is a very impressive castle. And there's actually historical documents, and that's, again, what makes the area rather unique, is that not only do we have the archaeological evidence, but we have some historical evidence that ties with the archaeological evidence, which makes a really compelling narrative.
Well, you're working in what seems to be a very large field, a pretty good size field. Where do you decide to drop that first trowel and start?
That's the number one question. That's the number one question I often hear from people. How do you know where to dig? And one of the great things about doing archaeology today is that we have a lot of technology to bring to the field. So we use a lot of things like aerial photography using UAVs and drones. We use ground science kinds of geophysical surveying tools. So we look for variations in the topography. We look for signatures in geophysical surveying, basically to focus our attention when we start to excavate.
And Kathy, you had access to some of that drone footage.
Absolutely.
And that really enhanced the project, it seems to me, because you could see undulations and things that you couldn't see from ground.
Yeah, Ireland is just a fascinating place. I mean, there's these settlement you know, structures underneath farms everywhere. And so I think all of us, the students and myself included, probably started to look at the landscape a different way, a little bit, maybe not to the extent Tom does, but you see these formations and it's like, I bet there's something under there. There's so much archaeology in that country.
But as a filmmaker, you know, I know that you don't, the team was how large, Tom?
I think we had 12, about 15? 12 or 15 students with a staff of three.
That's about what it looked like. Mm-hmm. Well, they're not all yelling Eureka in a couple of minutes. So here you are, a filmmaker, waiting for something to happen.
Yes, and we had two cameras, and we have 6 terabytes of footage. We had a lot of footage that we pared down to our 45-minute film. But, you know, that's how it is, and we knew it would be that way. We needed to keep a camera on the hill with them. And then the other camera and sometimes myself went other places to interview other scientists and archaeologists around the country.
Sure. Tom, back to the actual dig itself and what you've been learning. I mean, the things that you have found cover hundreds of years.
Right.
So what have you learned about the society that lived there over that period of time?
So one of the challenging things is that this particular era in basically the era after the English, the Anglo-Normans arrive in Ireland.
Which is about 1,200
It's about 1,200 or so. We have very little archaeological evidence for the native Gaelic people. And it's a complicated problem why that's the case, but let's just say for the moment that that is the case. And so what we've been trying to do, myself and colleagues, Michelle Comer, who's one of the folks that Kathy interviewed in the documentary, we're trying to fill in the blanks on this. And the challenging thing is that the English, when they comment on the Gaelic peoples, they often say, well, these people are living in huts. They don't build castles the way that we do. Mm-hmm. They don't dress the same way that we do. They don't have the same hairstyles that we do. And they don't have all the kind of luxuries that we do. So what often happens is we're trying to find something very different in the archaeology from, say, an English lordship, right? And so, but we don't know what it is. That's basically at heart the problem right now.
It's really detective work. I mean, there's no question about that.
It is.
You know, one of the things that fascinated me about the film was among the findings was a piece of jewelry from Venice, I guess it was.
With all of
the things that are there, all of a sudden this pops up.
So one of the things that we find on the west coast of Ireland is that the trade networks that the Gaelic peoples were a part of was actually vast. And this actually goes back into the era before, you know, our site was even occupied. So as far back as the Viking era in the 8th century, they're trading with as far east as say, you know, Moscow. And they're bringing in stuff from Byzantium, and they're bringing in stuff from the Mediterranean. So it happens more frequently than one would think. Amber, too. That's another thing they bring in from the Baltic countries.
Maybe you can clarify something that I suspect members of the audience may not be clear on, because I'm not entirely. When you talk about Gaelic history and you talk about Gaelic Ireland, what are we really talking about? Is that different from Ireland?
Sure. So the term Gaelic, when we talk about Gaelic Ireland, typically that refers to an era of around 1200 to about 1700. So it's really in the rest of Europe what we would call the late medieval period. And in a sense, Gaelic Ireland refers to that era where something was still there that retained a sense of Irishness, you might say, but that was very different from what the English were doing. And there is a lot of sort of back and forth play between the identities, and that's what makes it a complicated sort of identity.
Kathy, you didn't find any snakes there, I'll bet you.
We did not. We did not. Thank you, St. Patrick, for that. But I would
St. Patrick took care of this.
Yeah, thank you. To expand on what Tom said, I think that what really, you know, fascinated me about this was one of the comments Michelle Comer makes is, you know, growing up in Ireland, she was really never taught about, you know, the Irish of this period. It was all Anglo-Norman and castles and the English. And so what her work is doing, as well as Tom's, and I think this is the narrative of the film primarily, is it's starting to write a new page in the history books. We can't say it's writing a new history, but writing a new page and putting the history of some people back into the history books that has not been taught.
And I suppose if you really want to connect all those dots, you can have them run for that part of Ireland right here to St. Louis, because an awful lot of Irish wound up here.
That's true. That's true. I mean, a large population of St. Louis, at least from the late 19th century, came from Ireland, and we have Carey Patch and all those other neighborhoods of St. Louis where effectively that's what the neighborhoods were.
And another one of your findings that is made clear in the film, Tom, is the fact that these people were much more sophisticated than a lot of people might have supposed.
Well, again, this is the challenge of balancing various kinds of sources. So if you just look at the historical sources, say from an English perspective, they don't seem very sophisticated. In fact, they seem rather backwards. Now, if you look at the Gaelic sources for the same era, there's a certain level of sophistication and skepticism about the English. And then when you look at the archaeological record, it's almost a third narrative altogether. So that's the job of the historian and archaeologist, is to take these various bits and try to put them together with scientists, with, you know, other kinds of experts, and then try to weave one narrative out of the whole mess.
One of the things that interested me concerned the hierarchy, if you will, the Lord, who kind of ruled the roost, and then the others. They weren't exactly kings, but I guess they were close to it in a way.
Well, again, this was one of the things that confused the English, because Ireland at that point had 120 kings. now it complicates matters in one sense. But that designation as king basically wasn't in the same sense of king as, say, England and France at the same time around 1200. It was basically the highest status people in a given territory. So, for instance, where we were digging was the center of authority for the McDermotts. Mm-hmm. Now, he's the McDermott king, but he has an over-king, right, named the O'Connors. Yeah. So the O'Connors and the McDermotts, they more or less got along. They're both considered kings. And then under the McDermotts, there was one more tier of folks, and then that was basically that hierarchy.
But did they live in the kind of kingly fashion that we might suppose from history
again,
of England?
Right, again, therein lies part of the challenge, because when a king in England shows himself, he has regalia, he has, you know, a crown, he has a scepter. But a Gaelic king has a totally different sort of language, you might say, of kingship. So he won't wear the same kinds. He doesn't even have a crown. And so he might have actually literally just, you know, like what looks like a wand. And that is his staff of kingship. And he'll have retainers with him. And he'll basically be inaugurated on a dirt mound with a stone on it, as opposed to a throne. But that's where his ancestors, going all the way back into prehistory, were supposedly inaugurated.
And I guess this is supposed the English thought so little of the Irish.
In some respects, yes. That's, again, it's one of these kinds of things. Whenever the folks who were of Norman ancestry reach into these places like Scotland and Wales and Ireland and even into the Baltic regions and further east, you start noticing that there's a real... They can't comprehend these people because they are so different from that core of northern France and England. Mm. They just don't culturally register.
Were they warlike at all?
Extremely. with each other.
With each other.
Pick your person.
If you got 120 kings, I guess it's inevitable.
It was inevitable. And that was one of the other issues, that it was a very complicated political dynamic at the time. And compounded by the arrival of the English, compounded by climate change, frankly, in the 13th century, where there were more limited resources in Ireland. So it was a very complicated time there in the 13th century, and it's an extremely fruitful era to study for that reason.
Kathy, what of the artifacts that you witnessed discovered there interested you the most?
Well, I think we were all excited about the medieval coin, because one of the things that, as Tom said, you know, it really begins to prove that this was a trading center, that this was a much more sophisticated culture than anybody had thought. So I think the coin was pretty exciting for everybody.
That was a British coin, was it?
It was an English coin, yeah. Minted in London.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I just, it again is mind-boggling that you can find something like that. It looked about the size of a dime.
About the size of a dime, thinner, yeah. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about finding them? And I see the people with the with the trowels, and they're scraping the ground, and I didn't see any screens. I'm used to seeing screens.
No, they were off on the side, but funny enough, the coin was actually found by a colleague working with us from the University of Minnesota, Jimmy Scriver. And I mean, you'll see it in the video more or less, but he just said coin, and it was in the side of the excavation cutting. I mean, and it was perfectly set where we could use it as a date for the site in a lot of ways. But the things like a coin, because it's shiny, it stands out. It's silver. It wasn't tarnished. And it just stands out from the mud.
But in terms of your research, it's a terrifically important piece, isn't it?
It could not have been more perfect, to be honest. I mean, it was one of those things where I had colleagues who were giving me trouble about it because it was so perfectly placed, if you know what I mean.
I get you. What did it tell you other than the fact that there was commerce?
So the coin, the fact that it's minted in London, right, means...
And how do you know that?
Well, it says Londinium.
Oh, that's a pretty good clue.
Yeah. So it says London, so we know it's an English coin minted in London. Mm-hmm. We know from the design of the face that it's 1270, somewhere around there. But the place that it was located within the excavation was on top of some soil that had filled a ditch. And so the way that we work in archaeology is that we say everything below that we can reasonably say is roughly before the date of deposition of the coin. So we can roughly say it's in the 13th century. And so that was basically a confirmation that we were really looking for. I mean, to be blunt, that was sort of the goal of the project, was to confirm that the site was in the 13th century, which then opens the door to looking at the historical narrative and being able to concretely join the two pretty easily.
What about the significance of the horseshoe nails that you found?
Well, that was an interesting one too, because we didn't really think about that much till afterwards, because we were so focused on things like the coin and some of the other artifacts. But the horseshoe nail, we find pieces of iron, nails and things like that, and we just kind of throw them in a bag generally, and then we'll go back and look at it. But the horseshoe nails were interesting because we don't think the Irish were using horseshoes until the English arrived, that it was sort of a cultural import. But even more so, this particular kind of horseshoe nail called a fiddle nail is particular to, again, that era of the late 13th century. And so when we sat back and thought about it, we had about 10 or 12 of the things, and they all shoot to that particular time period. Again, the period that we were hoping to identify. So it was very fortuitous.
Can you describe the level of excitement you have when something like the coin or the nails that are important are...
Kathy, can you describe it? You were watching me.
Let's go to Kathy for that one.
Well, you know, archaeologists, I think I've learned that archaeologists are eternal optimists. You know,
really?
It's okay, we didn't find that, but we found this, you know, and that was a lot of the story, was that, you know, some of the things that they thought they would find based on geophysics, because you're looking underneath the ground, proved to be something else entirely. Some were maybe more, you know, impressive than others, like the kiln. The kiln proved to be a pretty impressive structure that they unearthed. But then other things, you know, it's sort of like they just rewrite the narrative a little bit as you go. It's a mystery. I mean, they're solving mysteries as they go.
You can maybe explain this to me. In your film, I notice a number of transactions that are kind of reenacted show people making a purchase by giving somebody what looked like acorns.
Hazelnuts.
Hazelnuts. I'm sorry.
Yeah. According to Tom, that was an item that was traded,
As currency?
Real simple.
Well, so if we really wanted to get precise, the actual currency at the time would have been cattle. Now, cattle is not exactly something that you can put in your pocket very easily. So they had this very complicated economy with various things that they would trade. It was effectively a bartering system. And so you had, But I guess at the outset, we weren't really clear what these Gaelic lords were using from themselves to the English. Mm-hmm. So what are they trading with the English? So you're at a lake, fish, right? Mm-hmm. And we know in the sources they always talk about cattle. But what else? And that was the other important thing that we discovered, that they're actually producing a lot of grain and that they're doing metalworking at the site.
What good, though, to the people who, the indigenous people there, what good is a silver coin from London if they're trading hazelnuts?
Ah, good question. Okay, so if you're the only one in the neighborhood who has a silver coin,
big shot.
You're a big shot. Or a Venetian piece of glass or a piece of amber that no one else can get. I mean, it's a prestige item. Really.
But if you want to buy some stout, is anybody
going
to
take it? You're probably making it out back, frankly.
Another question I had in watching it is, what kind of permission is necessary to do your digging? I mean, obviously, you have to go to the government.
Right. So the government of Ireland is very stringent about archaeological research. And so the licensing process is pretty strict. But you can't just dig a hole in the ground, even if it's your own land. It's a whole different kind of system. So I work with a colleague of mine, Alan Hayden, in Ireland, who worked most of the excavation licensing for us. Mm-hmm. And that actually helped quite a bit because he's an expert archaeologist and we were able to collaborate quite well together. But the licensing is both for the benefit of heritage in Ireland, which they aim to protect, but also to make sure that none of that heritage ever leaves Ireland.
Who gets custody of the silver coin? Do you get to stick it in your pocket or they have to leave it there?
Everything that is ever excavated is the property of the Irish government and the National Museum of Ireland, and that's by statute.
Kathy, did you need any special kind of permission to film there? I mean, were you kind of along for the ride?
Yeah, we were along for the ride, but of course there's permissions pretty much everywhere. But in Tom's case, he was on a private farm, mm-hmm. you know, so the farmer knew we were there. Other places that we went, abbeys and so on, we got permission from the monuments.
But you have to be very careful, I would have to think, in dealing with a regional history.
Mm-hmm. And Ireland protects, the country protects its archaeology very, very carefully. So,
well, folks who would like to have the opportunity to see True Gaelic will have that opportunity watching the world premiere this Thursday at 6:30 at the Center for Global Leadership at St. Louis University. Is that correct?
Global Citizenship.
Global mm-hmm. Citizenship.
On West Pine Mall. And I did get word that it will be on HEC on Saturday, October 14th at 7 p.m.
So. Okay. We'll put that information on our website. Yeah. Anybody invited to the premiere?
Everybody.
Everybody
open
invited.
To the public.
Well, it's a lot of fun to watch, and it's certainly a lot of fun to talk to you guys.
You.
I'm so glad we had the chance.
It's a real pleasure.
We're hoping for some international distribution as well, so it may be something streaming on Netflix. It's a St. Louis story, but it's an international story as well.
Well, the Irish better pick it up. That's what
yeah.
Thank you very much,
you.
Tom Finan and
Thank
Kathy
you.
Bartkowski. It's a pleasure seeing you.
Thank you.
St. Louis on the Air, a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.